Liebe ZuhörerInnen, hallo und herzlich willkommen auf dem Kampnagel-Podcast. Die folgende Audioaufnahme entstand bei dem Themenschwerpunkt »Geht ein Mann zum Arzt? Kritische und künstlerische Stippvisiten in die Gendermedizin«, der vom 27. bis 30. Januar auf Kampnagel stattfand. Wir wünschen viel Spaß beim Zuhören. Ich bin Alina Buchberger und gemeinsam mit meinen KollegInnen Nadine Jessen und Uta Lamberts haben wir das Performance- und Diskursprogramm dieses Wochenende gestaltet.
So, let me just really briefly introduce our speaker to you before I pass over the mic. Loretta J. Ross is an activist, public intellectual and a professor. She joined the women's movement in 1978 by working at the first rape crisis center in the country, and is a co-founder of Sister Song, which is a collective founded in 1997 by 16 women of color-led organizations to advocate for the reproductive and sexual health needs of women of color. Loretta Ross speaks, trains, consults, and lectures on many issues, including reproductive justice, appropriate whiteness, human rights, violence against women, and calling in the calling out culture. She currently teaches about the call-out culture and white supremacy as a professor at Smith College. Ross is co-author of Reproductive Justice, an Introduction from 2017, lead editor of Radical Reproductive Justice, Foundations, Theory, Practices and Critique from 2017 as well, co-author of Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Justice from 2004, amongst other titles, and has received numerous awards for her work. It would take up too much time to name all of these right now. Dear Loretta, I feel truly, truly honored that you accepted my invitation to speak about reproductive justice here today, a concept that is being used more and more in feminist activism and discourse here in Germany, and that needs to be understood precisely and also contextualized, both historically and concerning the present time. For our German-speaking audience, I do recommend the fourth edition of Kitchen Politics, this book, which is called Mehr als Selbstbestimmung, Kämpfe für reproduktive Gerechtigkeit, where you can find the German translation of an introduction to the concept written by Loretta Ross, and also an opening on how to apply the concept of reproductive justice in Germany by Antea Kiere, who will also today co-moderate our activist open space later and is here in the room, which is also a big honor and pleasure. And Deria Bineschik is also our moderator for later, but that is in the afternoon. So Loretta, thank you so much for the important work you have been and are still doing and for sharing your knowledge with us today.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. And it's an honor to be able to talk about reproductive justice with you. I don't have a lot of time. To be brief, reproductive justice is a human rights-based framework. And it was created by African-American women because we needed a way to talk about reproductive politics that included an analysis of neoliberal capitalism and white supremacy. Because if you don't understand those two forces of neoliberal capitalism and white supremacy, you won't understand the overmanagement of the reproduction of vulnerable people in general and Black women in particular. We came to America as kidnapped Africans and were forced to breed as a wealth-producing strategy for a slave-based economy. And since the end of slavery, that same breeding that we were forced to do is now criticized as our children are seen as a problem for the economy, for the educational system, for the criminal justice system, for the environment, and et cetera. So reproductive justice was created as a critique of all strategies of population control and the thinking or the philosophy, if you can call it that, of eugenics, the false belief that you can breed superior human beings at the expense of more vulnerable human beings. And of course, I don't have to lecture anybody in Germany about the dangers of that false philosophy. In short, reproductive justice centers Black women when it was created in the lens, because we do join with the pro-choice movement that fights for abortion rights and birth control here in the United States. We join and support them in fighting for the right to use abortion and birth control and abstinence if one chooses to abstain. And so our agenda overlaps with what is called the pro-choice movement. But because we were African-American women who conceptualized this framework, we also fight for the right to have the children that we want to have. And moreover, we fight for the right to have those children under the conditions that we want to have those children. So that's fighting for the right to use birth doulas and midwives, for example, or to resist unnecessary cesarean sections that are imposed by a medical industrial complex. And then the third tenet of reproductive justice is the right to raise our children in safe and healthy environments. And of course, it is a challenge to raise a child under a white supremacist neoliberal capitalist system, because that means we have to deal with violence. We have to deal with climate change and environmental problems. We have to deal with an unfair tax system here in the United States. We have to deal with a school to prison pipeline where children are pushed out of school if they're vulnerable into a prison system here. And of course, the United States incarcerates more people than any other country in the world that has options, particularly in the global north. And so we have a lot of challenges that interfere with our right to raise our children in safe and healthy environments and to protect our human rights and the human rights of our children. And we insist upon using the human rights framework to underpin reproductive justice because we find that the US Constitution is entirely too limited in protecting the rights of people who were not intended to be protected in the US Constitution, because our Constitution was written to only benefit and protect the rights of white men who owned property at the time. And we've been in a multi-year struggle trying to get other people included in the Constitution. For example, we are still fighting for the Equal Rights Amendment to include women in the US Constitution. So you can see it's an entirely inadequate document for the protection of the human rights that we demand. Now, speaking of human rights, the one thing I want to make sure that I emphasize is that although reproductive justice was created by Black women, it is a universal framework that's applicable to all people because it is based upon the human rights framework. And we all have the same human rights. But you use the concept of intersectionality created by Kimberly Crenshaw, another universal Black feminist theory, in order to determine what your vulnerabilities are that need to be attended to so that you can enjoy the same human rights as everyone who does not have those vulnerabilities. And the best way I can explain that would be to say that every child has a human right to an education, but a blind child might need her books in Braille. She does not have special human rights. She has special human needs that an intersectional analysis says that have to be attended to so that she can enjoy the same human rights as a sighted child. And that's how you use the concept of intersectionality as the process to achieve human rights as the outcome when you're using the reproductive justice framework. The other thing to consider about reproductive justice is that it goes beyond the biological processes of reproduction into social, economic, political, and cultural issues as well. And so there's a fourth tenet of reproductive justice that was added about a decade after the original framework was conceptualized that talks about the human right to sexual pleasure, to body autonomy, to gender identity, so that reproductive justice could be expanded to include trans people and people who wanted to assert their right to bodily self-determination outside of a reproduction lens, whether or not they were going to have children or not. And so one of the things I really admire about reproductive justice as a framework is its elasticity, its adaptability, and the way it can be expanded to include new populations and new conversations. So for example, if someone is dealing with citizenship or immigration issues, then they're going to reframe reproductive justice in a way that puts more of an emphasis on those vulnerabilities than someone who doesn't have citizenship or immigration issues to be concerned about. The same way someone who is disabled will put more of an emphasis on the disability injustices that they face than someone who is not disabled. And so reproductive justice ends up being a criteria-based framework as opposed to an identity-based framework. In other words, as long as you use the human rights framework, that you understand it is an intersectional framework and a way to explore which vulnerabilities have to be attended to so that people enjoy their human rights, that if it that there's a dialectical relationship between what happens at the local level and what happens globally is a part of reproductive justice. It has to offer a critique of white supremacy and neoliberal capitalism, and it has to talk about power relationships and shift, if possible, the whole discussion of how power is arranged and shared and distributed as a way of both advantaging certain people's reproduction and disadvantaging other people's reproduction. So you have to talk about all of those things in order to properly use the reproductive justice framework. But if you talk about those things with the criteria that I've articulated now and even more that I put in my three books, then, generally speaking, you will be able to properly use and expand and build upon the reproductive justice framework. But it is not an identity-based framework. I want to emphasize that it's not something that only applies to Black women or only applies to disabled people or only applies to trans or queer people. It is not an only applies kind of framework. And an interpretation of that is rather a racist interpretation, if that is the lens that is used, because it presumes, first of all, that African-American women cannot create universal theory, which of course is not true, and that basing a theory of reproductive politics on human rights is not possible, and that also is not true, and that we don't need to have a vision for what we want to achieve while we limit ourselves to what our opponents say is merely possible, and that's not true as well. So I invite y'all into the reproductive justice movement using the criteria that I have outlined. As I said, there's a lot more reading that you can do in the kitchen table, in the Kitchen Politics book that was mentioned earlier. And I really welcome you and the audience to continue to talk about and unfold the tremendous possibilities of the reproductive justice framework. I'm not sure whether people appreciate how powerful it is to have a clear vision for what you're fighting for instead of constantly only focusing on what you're fighting against. I think having that hope, that vision, and that roadmap towards full human rights is the scariest thing that our opponents really fear. So thank y'all for listening to me, and I hope we have some questions and discussion to follow.
There's one question coming in.
Can I ask you all a question? How did you hear about reproductive justice? And what attracts a German audience to a framework that's about human rights that originated in the United States?
So,
okay, this is double nervous state for me because talking to you and answering your question, I hope I try to, I'll manage. Okay, so to answer your question first, but firstly, thank you for your keynote and your words and for getting up at 7 a.m. on a Sunday to talk to us. Yeah, well, for me personally, the very first time I heard about the framework of reproductive justice was within the work for a queer feminist collective I joined last year. It was called Nocturnal Unrest, and we organized a queer feminist festival in Frankfurt am Main in Germany, discussing questions of femininities, sexualities at night, and the movements which arose, for instance, in Britain with the women's protests at night against violence and sexual harassment. Well, it was the first context, and the very thing that impressed me was one of the points you pointed out in your keynote, the right to become and raise children, how Black women, how BIPOC women want to, because I always thought about the abortion movement like something to prohibit the pregnancy, but I never thought of a pregnancy in a way how to encourage pregnant people to get the children in on terms how they want to and how they feel good about. So that was the very first thing that struck me when hearing about reproductive justice. Now, I don't know if I can ask my original question or if people want to answer your question first. Okay, I will ask my question. Do you maybe have an example from your everyday life or from your professional career of an implemented example where reproductive justice did something good, maybe a project or something that occurs to you as a good situation where the framework really did something good? Is it understandable?
Yes, we have a lot of little victories in the midst of the news that is dominated only with abortion politics. So it's very hard to find the good news in the midst of the media's obsession with only talking about abortion. So it's very understandable that the victories we are achieving are not known because they're just not considered important. For example, we have had a lot of good work around ending sterilization abuse and compensating the victims of sterilization abuse take place in states like North Carolina and California because the states are finally admitting that they are doing or have done harm to people. And in some cases, they are compensating people who were involuntarily and immorally sterilized. Because as you know, many things can be legal and still be immoral. And that's the situation that we have here in the United States, that a number of things are done to people that are immoral, but they're still legal. Another victory we had very recently is in our immigration and detention center, where women were being improperly sterilized because they lacked documentation to obtain their citizenship. under the Immigration Customs and Enforcement Services. And so the reproductive justice and immigration rights movement organized to stop that practice, to hold people accountable who were committing that injustice, and to shut down the facilities at which those kinds of illegal sterilizations were taking place. We are also finding a lot of work happening around the foster care system and the child removal system, around finding indigenous people who have been kidnapped and unearthing the stories of what's happened to them. We're also, in one way that I'm quite proud of, creating an intersection between the movement to end violence against women and the movement to end reproductive oppression. Because of course, a time when women are most vulnerable is when they are pregnant and in the middle of a intimate partner violence or domestic violence situation. There's an alarming increase in how pregnant women are violated or experience domestic violence. So we have to make sure that people who provide services to address violence against women also understand reproductive justice and the vulnerability of people to reproductive violence or reproductive oppression. The women's health movement is using the reproductive justice framework very successfully to fight unnecessary cesarean sections or to obtain the right of midwives and doulas to attend births in hospitals or in non-hospital birthing sessions. I mean, I could go on, but again, all of these victories are taking place outside of the view or the reporting of the mainstream media, so you wouldn't have any real idea that they're going on because of their obsession with only talking and focusing on abortion.
This is Alina speaking. I have received two questions from our webinar. Maybe I can quickly, before also answer your question, Loretta, because I think that inviting you here is also contextualized in a very current German context, where under the new government, we finally have a chance to legalize abortion in Germany and also get rid of a paragraph that forbids any information about abortion being given publicly by health practitioners. So in the sculpting of these new paragraphs and context in Germany, I think it was important in this framework of the festival to also consider not only the topic of legalization of abortion, but also think about everything that is involved with the concept of reproductive justice. So I think your knowledge is very much appreciated. And I think we should all in our feminist and queer activist contexts be aware of these thoughts that you have just brought to us. So that's just from my personal side. I could read out the two questions that came from the webinar, if that's okay. The question is, thank you so much for your incredible work. I loved you talking about fighting for instead of against. Could you expand a bit more?
It's very important, I think, for those of us who believe in freedom, justice, and human rights, to have a vision of what we're fighting for and spend as much time articulating that vision as we spend describing what we're fighting against. Because it would be terrible to win and not know what comes next. What kind of society are we trying to construct? And I think we're at grave risk of replicating the same oppressive patterns that we've endured and grown up with because we have not conceptualized what should be different. And so that's why I put a lot of emphasis in my activism and my scholarship on describing what we're fighting for so that we have an idea, a blueprint of the type of society we would like to see if we are fortunate enough to win the power to construct that society. So I want a society that's free from all violences, for example, free from personal violence, free from economic violence, free from racial violence or immigration violence or identity violence, for example. Well, what would that society look like? What would a violence-free society look like, and how would it handle the violences that take place within that society? We need to have those conversations now so that we're not caught off guard or ill-prepared. As a matter of fact, I gave a lot of Martin Luther King speeches last week because of the birthday of Martin Luther King here in the States is widely celebrated. And so, and in my speeches last week, I kept emphasizing that our opponents to human rights don't realize that they're not fighting us. You know, if they were just fighting people who are on the left or devoted to human rights, they probably would feel very assured of their victory because they have all the power, they have all the money, they have all the attention. But the fact is, they're not fighting us. They're fighting other things. They're fighting time. They're fighting truth. They're fighting evidence, and they're fighting history. And any one of those things could kick their asses because no one can turn back time. No one can permanently deny the truth or bury evidence or revise history. You just can't do that. And so I'm concerned that we keep our eye on the human rights we want to fight for and achieve, and not self-destruct on the way to victory, not get in our own way, as they say, snatch defeat out of the jaws of victory, because we're up against people stupid enough to think that they can defeat truth, time, evidence, and history. And that's a hand I would not like to play, because all of those things are on our side, not theirs.
Thank you. I have one question from the webinar, and then we have a last question in the room, and I think then we can wrap it up, if that's okay. So the question from the webinar is from an anonymous spectator who asks, there is a debate currently about reproductive technologies, whether the right to access, for example, surrogacy or Excel for LGBT people should be part of reproductive justice, e.g. the right to have children, or whether this instrumentalizes and exploits the bodies of others on the basis of social inequality. How do you debate this issue in your contexts and groups?
There is a considerable discussion amongst the reproductive justice community about what we call assisted reproductive technologies. And of course, that includes surrogacy, the renting of other people's wombs in order to have children. While we talk about the human right to have a child as a reproductive justice value, that right does not come without any attention to other people's vulnerabilities. You don't have the human right to exploit vulnerable people. Matter of fact, your human right can't be achieved by violating someone else's human rights. That's a contradiction in terms and stuff. And so that's a conversation we need to have about whether or not we can have surrogacy programs that are non-exploitative, because right now they are subjected to the whims of capitalist arrangements where the people with the money get to exploit the people without money as a way to achieve their parenting. And that is not acceptable. At the same time, I think we need to have a real conversation about this whole ingestion of white supremacist ideology that says that the only way and the best way to parent is your own DNA. What the hell makes your DNA that damn special? I mean, this whole worship of blood, genes, and politics is a manifestation of a white supremacist neo-fascist way of seeing the world. And whether you have a different claim to a different identity doesn't mean that you are not subjected to and vulnerable to the same kind of patriarchal values around worshiping your own DNA, your own paternity or maternity stuff that anybody is vulnerable to. And so that's a conversation that I think we need to have, because there are so many children available who need loving parents that are already here. Why are you dedicated to having your DNA replicated as if that's the only DNA worth parenting by you? That's more a statement of your ego than your desire to actually provide love to another human being as a parent. But we don't have those conversations because it's almost like it's verboten to even bring up the subject of whether or not we've ingested the patriarchy to the extent that we believe that our genes are so special that they must be preserved and replicated. And that's the same old blood politics that we offer a critique of when they're accompanied by symbols we don't like, but we say it's okay when we attach them to an identity that we do like.
So hello, first of all, thank you so much for your work. And I wanted to refer to the question you asked before to the audience. And I'm answering that question from a perspective of a Black woman living in Germany, originated in Africa. And basically it's that gender medicine discourses and discourses about abortion in Germany are so inaccessible for Black people. And it's so important that we like use your work to talk about it. And I really love that you put the emphasis on that Black people are the blueprints of the discourses about reproductive justice. And here in Germany, we're not even close to being like, in a state of equality talking about abortion rights, especially when we consider Germany's history about the treatment of Black women when it comes to gynecology, because like German people, German people used to perform gynecologist experiments on the Overheron Nama and in Namibia, and they haven't talked about it since. So talking about abortion rights or reproductive justice here in Germany without considering Germany's history and like what they did to Black women is so harmful and so disrespectful. And I really appreciate that you really put the emphasis on it's Black women, Black femme, Black trans people talking about it and creating these frameworks. And like gender medicine here in Germany is not accessible for any person of color at this point. So that's very important that we could listen to you.
Well, thank you for that observation. One thing I say about our current situation is that most of us need to understand the distinction between blame versus responsibility, because none of us are alive who created this system of injustice that we all live under. But we all bear a responsibility to end it. That's the difference between blame versus responsibility. To teach this in my class, I talk about how if you just bought a house and you're now the proud owner of this house, and then you discovered that that house has bad plumbing in it, well, you can't be blamed for the fact that that house has bad plumbing because you're not responsible. You can't be blamed for what happened before you bought that house. But as the new homeowner, you are responsible for fixing that plumbing because you enjoy the benefits of living in that house, the benefits of owning that house. Well, that's how we are in our countries right now. We can't be blamed for the genocide that the Native Americans experienced, you know, hundreds of years ago, and it's continuing. Or we can't be blamed for what happened in what they used to call Tanganyika and Namibia and all of that. But we can bear responsibility for fixing those things, for making sure that the horrors of the past are remembered and not repeated and are taught so that they can't be repeated. But I have to be honest, Germany does a much better job of accounting for its fascists than the United States does, because we elect them to office still. And so we've got a longer way to go in many ways. But I think we can get out of our paralysis and our guilt if we understand the distinction between being blamed for a situation and then accepting the responsibility for addressing that situation. And the other thing that I teach in my classes at Smith College and other stuff is, instead of being ashamed of one's identity around whiteness, because whiteness is just an identity, why don't you repurpose that white identity as a way to attack the ideology of Aryan superiority and whiteness? That is a real way to stop feeling guilt or shame or paralysis and really evince another way of being proud about your identity, because your identity is used in the service of justice and human rights. And that is something that I would like to see lots more of globally, because right now, the only people who are talking about taking pride in a white identity are the ones using it all in the wrong way and for the wrong purposes and stuff. They're using it to support the fascist ideas. And we need to have people who take pride in white identities dedicating themselves to the anti-fascist movement and doing it from a place of white pride around repurposing whiteness and repopulating the white identity with the commitment to fighting fascism and white supremacy all over the world, and to retell our histories in such a way that we achieve truth, justice, accountability, and reconciliation.
Thank you very much for this answer and these questions in the room and the webinar. I'm very, very sorry, but I think we need to move on to the panel discussion. I'm sorry because we have to leave you now on the screen, Loretta, but I'm also very happy because we will have great panelists here on stage. So first of all, let me thank you from all my heart for having taken the time to speak to us today and to engage in this conversation. I think that we will carry on your thoughts throughout the day in the panel and also in our activist conversations that we'll have in the afternoon. And yes, I hope you enjoy your Sunday. And if you want to follow up with the program here, you can just log into the Zoom and follow our discussions. Thank you so much, Loretta.
Thanks for having me. Y'all have a good day.